Thank you. I'm sorry, I know the room is really full and I know you can't hear me at the back. There's nothing I can do. I'm just going to ask you to be all as quiet as you possibly can and we'll just see how we get along. To my knowledge, this was actually originated by Jackie Stewart, the racing driver, who was once asked, does a racing driver need to be a good engineer? Now this was at a time when, in the past, basically every racing driver had to be an engineer, and things were changing. This would have been 1970. And he thought, and he paused, and you can hear his brain work, and he said, no, you don't have to be an engineer to be a racing driver, but you do have to have mechanical sympathy. And that's what this talk is about. Think about the machine that your program is actually running on. And understand that the machine underneath is really fake. It's designed to look like a sequential computer, but that's not what's actually going on. Like all abstractions, it's leaky. And knowledge of where the abstraction leaks can help you understand why your program performance does odd things sometimes and what you might do to make it better. This is a slight oversimplification. What we're actually looking at here is a capacitor in series with a resistor, and I'm going to make a few grossly simplified assumptions here. Of course, what a computer actually is just a box full of switches, but it has capacitance and it has resistance. Now, if you do a few calculations, and I hope there's no electrical engineers in this room. You assume that the reactance of the capacitor is substantially greater than the reactance of the resistor that's in series with it. Then do a few calculations based on the impedance. You know the resistor dissipates all the power. You do a few calculations. You realize very quickly that the power increases quadratically with the frequency going through the system. What this means is the faster you want to go, the less efficient your computer is going to be. There's a non-linear. So if you double the frequency, the power goes up four times. Every single calculation you do takes twice as fast when you're going, sorry, it takes twice as much power, it takes twice as many joules of energy when you're running at high speed than it does when you're running at low speed. So every operation is costing twice as much when you run your computer at high frequency. This is why high-performance computers have slipped from 5 gigahertz or so, or maybe 10 years ago, and they've gone down. Because we're limited by power. This first sentence is, again, slightly untrue, but it's sort of similar. If you look at the heat transfer coefficient that a CPU cooler can do, it's not madly different from the heat exchanger in the primary cooling circuit of a nuclear reactor. Astonishing but true. Of course, nuclear reactors are shifting more heat because they're hotter. Well, usually. But a modern CPU cooler is a tremendous piece of engineering. We cannot increase power consumption anymore. This is particularly true in data centers, where I think every data center I've ever visited was over its original design budget for power by about 50%. We're running into all of these physical limits. So, we can't go any faster. And there are very good physical reasons for concluding that we're probably never going to be able to go any faster, at least with the types of computers that we have now, which is boxes full of very, very dense semiconductors. So we're going to have to go wider. We're going to have to, instead of doing things twice as fast, we're going to have to do a lot more operations in parallel. And this is something that's been going on for a very long time. In fact, these very wide parallel computers that pretend to be sequential machines really go back to the end of the 1960s, when T.J. Watson famously asked an engineer, why you've got hundreds of people working on the System 360, but it's still slower than this computer over here, designed by 12 people working in a shed. One of the answers was, well, it's because you've got 300 people working on it, obviously. The guy with 12 people in a shed was Seymour Cray. And that was perhaps the difference. But the response of IBM was to invent something like the modern superscalar, very wide issue computer. This is what the computer of today actually looks like. And if there's one thing I'd like you to take away from this session, just think about what this actually is. At the top here, this is your instruction pad. On every single clock cycle, 10 instructions are decoded in parallel. Down. Now this is an ARM 64 computer. There are similar diagrams for Intel x86 computers. Their decoders are much, much more complicated because Intel have variable length instructions. on Intel, an instruction is just a stream of bytes. So you don't know where it's going to start, you don't know where it's going to end. Sometimes you don't know where it's going to end until you actually get partway through. So instruction decoding in Intel is very, very much harder. And the reason that the ARM64 is like this is because it was designed to do this thing. It's amazingly highly when the architecture was invented more than 10 years ago. They knew they were going to get it. So, all of these instructions are decoded. It goes with the code scheme. This is interesting. Look at this. What this is telling you is that although the architecture of the computer instruction set only has 32 or 64 registers, the physical... didn't expect it to do that. I'm going to have to keep prodding it. The physical machine has 900 physical registers. So what happens in the front here when you start decoding an instruction is there's what's called a rename table, which basically says, okay, when the next instruction asks for register 16, what you actually want is register 571 or something. So it's a massive lookup table. But of course, if you're going to execute all of these instructions in a different order from they are in the program, you've got to do a tremendous amount of work keeping track of what order things are going to be in and so on. And that's the reorder buffer here, which keeps... So this is what's actually going on. And you can see here that... And you can see here that there are different instruction blocks here for various things that you might want to do. So this is what the machine actually looks like. Now most people, even people who work on compilers for a living, tend not to think in terms of this amazing machine that it really is. Most compilers, even sophisticated optimizing compilers, don't know about any of this. They're actually based around a model of a straightforward inline issue register machine. But conditional branches are very, very common. Some people reckon that there's a branch every 5 or 6 instructions, something like that. So in order to use all of that machinery there, you have to predict where the program is going to go. This is called speculation, this is called branch prediction. But memory loads are predicted as well, not just branches. So sometimes a machine will simply say, okay, I've been reading memory sequentially, let's just predict it in the absence of any other knowledge. We're just going to keep reading things sequentially. And this works an awful lot of the time. Almost all memory reads are sequential. So let's just think about what a clock cycle actually is for a moment. It's the simplest operation that you've got. It's a logical operation, an AND, an OR, an ADD, or something like that, which is typically limited by some number of gate delays, which is like 16 or 20, typically. Memory read from a level 1 cache is a lot longer than that. That's a whole nanosecond. Multiplication of 3 to 5, etc., etc. Memory read from DRAM takes forever and a day. It's a huge, huge latency relative to short read. So, what you actually want to do is try to arrange your program so that it works well on that sort of machine. I imagine that most people programming in high-level language will not really be aware of all this magic, because the CPU designers are trying to hide the magic from you. They really don't want you to know. They're trying to give you a perfect illusion. But occasionally, as we saw with Spectre meltdown bugs, this very carefully hidden abstraction really does start to make stuff, but it also affects how fast your program is going to run. So these are three things that I've done which are affected by this. Stokes values, Mark Reinhold mentioned them earlier, the new Java feature, but reading a Stokes value conceptually walks up the Java stack to find a caller. Linear search can be slow, so we were looking at various things that we could do. And in the end, came up with a 16-way software cache, entirely software managed, which is local to each thread. So whenever you look for the value of a Stokes value, rather than walking down the stack, you just look it up in this cache, bang. Now, a CPU can predict memory loss, so the data is there early, and there's no delay reading through memory. So I implemented this software cache, and it turned from being a slow walk in the stack into something that was literally unbelievable. Like, in many cases, there was no overhead at all. Some of this was to do with the brilliance of the Java server compiler. An awful lot of it was to do with prediction. The processor would just scan forward long before the stuff time would get was actually issued. Look at that. And it was just there. So it was essentially, it's always perfectly predictable. So this idea, if you've got any lookup that you're doing, and it's a lookup which is likely to be repeatedly fetched, try it. Just a tiny little cache, and the one that's actually in the Stokes value source code, that's an obvious implementation you can try to see if it works for you. But it works incredibly fast, and it's particularly good because I spent a lot of time looking at the actual assembly code output that the C2 compiler was producing for accesses to the Stokes value cache. So a small cache is highly effective for many algorithms. Okay. So last year, I seem to have spent much of the year doing this, there was a problem with the old way that interface membership tests had done. The old algorithm was very fast, but it really scaled badly under multi-threaded load. So when it was first designed, and this is 20-year-old code, it was perfect. But now, as soon as different threads started asking the same question, the performance just died because you've got a tremendous amount of cache coherence traffic going between the various processes, and it was extremely slow. So the algorithm benchmarked at 1.4 nanoseconds. Now, from what I've said earlier, you can see that there's no way you can possibly check anything in 1.4 nanoseconds. That's essentially nothing. I mean, if you're looking at the speed of light in CPU, it's about that. So it was never going to be like that. So I thought, at this point, I got interested. I thought, I don't believe this. What is actually going on? It is this. The CPU will always speculate for the check cache will succeed. Because the CPU knows that it always does. Thank you. So unless the guarded code uses all of the CPU width, which is very unlikely, especially in that monster of a server, check cache costs almost nothing. And here it is. Now, you probably can't see that at the back, and you probably can't see it at the front either. But this first part is the check case. It's that. It's, I think, 9 instructions. And you see, this isn't the ARM processor that I showed you, because I can't get a pipeline model for it. You can see that the actual code that's guarded by the check code actually begins 2 cycles after the check cast code is first issued. Now granted, the check cast code takes until there, so it actually takes 30 cycles. But it doesn't matter, because the processor executes all this, and if the check cast fails, it will throw away all of this and rewind everything, throw away all that work that it's done, and start again. So, this is the failure. I wanted to do more of the same by improving the algorithm used for invoke interface. I thought we could do something similar. I thought we could do a nice hash table lookup. This is a benchmark in OpenJDK. And when it runs on the machine I was testing it on, it runs in less than 4 nanoseconds. That is completely impossible. Clearly it's doing something. And what it's actually doing here, it's predicting memory loads. So I changed the benchmark to scramble these processes into a different order. And all of a sudden, woohoo, this is what happened. Yeah. It's actually executing 75 instructions, so I changed it, and all of a sudden, the performance went right down. So it was all about prediction. So I'm running out of time, and this is perhaps a longer talk, but the point is that invoke interface is legendarily in Java supposed to be a slow operation. It really isn't a slow operation if it's well predicted. If it's poorly predicted, then not only is the code that does the lookup likely to be predicted badly, but the whole target method is going to be predicted badly too. And simply scrambling like that reduced the performance so badly that it was doing 6 instructions per clock down to less than 1, because it was always executing the whole method twice, once with the right information, once with the wrong information speculated, and once again. So, if there's one thing to take away from this, invoke interface is nothing to be scared of. Interfaces are the very heart and soul of Java. But if you want them to be executed quickly, then that will only happen if prediction works accurately. Now, we don't know exactly how prediction really does work, but it tells you, keep it simple. Keep all of your stuff simple. If you try and do elaborate lookups and tests and so on, you'll probably confuse the prediction machinery. And it quite well happens, like my attempt here, everything I tried was worse than a simple sequential search. Keep it simple, stupid. I've overrun, sorry.